This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick, Senior News Editor at New Scientist, and I'm sitting in for Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, the science behind a touchy political issue, third trimester abortions, and how a California wildfire is having an unexpected benefit for butterflies. But first, you may have encountered a protest that disrupted your day, blocking traffic on your route to work, for instance. And maybe you grumbled to yourself that this sort of disruptive protest is not winning any hearts and minds. But new research finds that it could actually have a positive effect. Here to talk more about that and other stories from the week in science is Jason Dinn, climate editor at Atmos in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell me about this study.
Yeah, I think some listeners may find this result to be quite surprising, but in this new study that was published in the journal Nature Sustainability, social scientists found that disruptive, high-profile climate protests can actually boost public support for moderate climate groups. This runs counter to a widespread opposition we often hear whenever these more fringe demonstrations happen, right? There's this gut feeling that disrupting people's lives might hurt support for social movements. But this study showed that that isn't the case. And in fact, it can actually increase support. This particular study looked at a case from the UK in 2022, when the group Just Stop Oil shut down the country's busiest motorway, the M25, for 4 days. They found that within weeks of that demonstration happening, public support for more moderate environmental groups like Friends of the Earth increased. And scientists and activists have theorized that these radical fringes of social movements might have this type of consensus building effect, but this is really the first time they've been able to test it in real time in response to an actual protest.
So the research was just looking at this one specific protest, not some of the other forms of disruption we've seen, like the people who throw soup on famous paintings.
Yeah, exactly. They polled about 1,400 people in response to this particular protest.
And do they know why people increase their support for the environmental cause, even though they had to put up with this action that might have annoyed them personally?
So we can't really point to a precise mechanism based on this study, and the reason why any individual changes their mind is probably going to differ person to person. But in general, the finding supports this hypothesis called the radical flank effect, where there's a heightened awareness of an issue sparked by a radical group, and that increases solidarity with and support for the more moderate ones.
Okay, stepping back in time for a moment, you also have a story this week about a tiny feathered dinosaur?
Yeah, what a great hook, right? This study was published in the journal PNAS, and it analyzed these fossilized footprints that were left behind by a tiny raptor, so a relative of T-Rex, that was about the size of a sparrow. And the distance between consecutive footsteps on one set of these dinosaur tracks were so far apart that the scientists who published the study said that the animal must have been flapping its wings to generate lift and lengthen its stride to be able to produce them. Some even think that this track might have been left behind as the dinosaur was taking off for flight, like, you know, a plane accelerating down the runway before it goes airborne. And the really interesting part about this theory is that this species isn't part of the dinosaur lineage that eventually evolved into birds. So if the theory holds up, it could suggest that flying evolved multiple times across different dinosaur lineages.
I have to say, this image of like a tiny T-Rex running at top speed while flapping its arms is very extremely cute.
Yeah, it would make a great Pixar movie.
But not everyone agrees on this interpretation, right?
Yeah, that's right. There are definitely skeptics. So this is all based on a comparison between just two tracks of footprints. Some skeptics say that maybe that track has footprints from multiple individuals, not one individual. Others think that maybe they don't actually represent consecutive footprints. Maybe some of the intervening ones were erased over time. But the study authors are pretty insistent, even though they want to be conservative, that they suspect that this is some sort of pre-flight run.
And going even further back in time, let's look back to when the planet was largely a water world, and then an ancient asteroid came along.
Yeah, so this goes all the way back 3 billion years to Earth's early history. And just to paint the picture for you, Earth was mostly water at the time. There were a few volcanoes and large islands that jutted out above the sea surface, and there was very little life aside from microbes. And This asteroid that these researchers studied, named S2, was about 50 to 200 times larger than the one that killed the dinosaurs.
Wow.
The surprising result here is that although this asteroid was pretty devastating when it hit Earth, it may have been beneficial to life in the short to medium term. So when this asteroid hit Earth, it basically caused these massive tsunamis. It evaporated the top layer of the ocean, and it sent up to 10,000 cubic kilometers of debris into space. And that blocked out the sun. All that debris eventually recondensed as these molten droplets that then rains back down onto the surface of the Earth. So, as you can imagine, that's pretty devastating. But they say that only lasted, you know, a few years, maybe a few decades. But after all of that dust settled, apparently the seas were, you know, starved for nutrients at the time. And this asteroid actually brought 360 billion metric tons of phosphorus, a really critical nutrient, from space into the oceans. And the tsunamis that it caused circulated the oceans in a way that lifted iron and other nutrients from the deep up to the surface where primitive photosynthesizing microbes could use them. So essentially, it was this huge extraterrestrial fertilizer for early Earth. The scientists who did this study compared it to like brushing your teeth, where you wipe out a whole bunch of the microbes in the morning, but by midday, a bunch of them are resilient and they bounce back.
Let's skip back forward in time again to the time of the Silk Road. Tell us about this story.
If you remember back to your history lessons, the Silk Road was this famous network of trade routes that connected Europe and China for about 1,500 years. It was really long thought that all of the major hubs in the network were these low altitude cities that had enough water and fertile land to cope with harsh desert conditions. But now, in the journal Nature, scientists reported that they discovered a previously unknown city within the Silk Road that's 2,000 meters up in the mountains of modern-day Uzbekistan. And this is a really major discovery because cities were rarely built at high altitudes in medieval times. There are only a few that we know of, like Cusco in Peru or Lhasa in Tibet. And one expert who wasn't involved in this study even told Science that the discovery of this mountain metropolis could force us to rethink what the Silk Road looked like, but it could also rewrite the history of Central Asia more broadly.
Wow. Do we know what people were doing up there in the mountains then?
Yeah, so based on the excavations that they were doing, they found that there was, you know, a pretty big foundry and a furnace and a ton of iron ore nearby. So they think that the city was a big steel manufacturer and exporter. And because there weren't many permanent structures within the fortified parts of the city, they also think that the residents were highly mobile. So maybe they were sheep or goat herders who pitched yurts up in the mountains during the summer, but went back to the lowlands when it got cooled in the winter.
Changing directions entirely, there's a story this week about the people who are born without the ability to smell.
Yes, this new study was published in Nature Communications, and it found that people who are born without a sense of smell breathe differently than those who have a typical sense of smell. Essentially, the shapes of the inhales and exhales differ between those two groups. And the most obvious difference was that people with a typical sense of smell tended to have a tiny inhalation peak at the top of their breath, as if they were investigating their environment for different smells and odors. They made these conclusions based on a data set with just over 50 people. 21 of them were born without smell. 31 of them had a typical sense of smell. And the researchers gave them these relatively unobstructive devices that could measure nasal breathing continuously for 24 hours. And then they sent them home wearing this device to go about the rest of their day. When the researchers got the data back and were able to spot these subtle differences in breath, they could actually build a predictive model that could guess with 83% accuracy whether a person was born with their sense of smell or not, based solely on the differences in their breathing.
And what's the value of knowing this? How does this help us?
The authors think that this might be related to a bevy of health effects that arise when people don't have a sense of smell, like depression or early mortality. But a lot of outside experts say that it's way too premature to make those leaps of causality. And there needs to be a lot more research done before we can start thinking about that.
Staying on the health track for a moment, there's also news this week from a trial of people with depression who used a brain stimulation technique.
Yeah, these results come from a phase 2 trial for this new depression treatment, and they were published in the journal Nature Medicine. They're looking into this novel treatment that applies tiny currents of electrical stimulation to the brain, specifically in areas that are known to be affected by depression. Basically, patients put on this headset wearing two electrodes that apply this current, and they wear it for half an hour at a time, a few times a week, over the course of 10 weeks. In this trial, the patients were actually self-administering this treatment from their own homes while they were being supervised by the researchers conducting this study. And compared to the control group, those that received this treatment were twice as likely to have their depression go into remission. So about 45% of them did. And if this treatment goes on to get approved, it could be a game changer on a few fronts. It could be huge for the one-third or so of depression patients who never go into remission using current psychotherapies and medications. And depending on how well it's implemented, it could also be a big boost to healthcare accessibility. The treatment can be done in your home as you go about your normal life, and there's no need to find and go to a specialized clinic every day. Of course, there's some doubt, as these trials always have, but even some of the skeptics have told journalists that they agree with the authors that this could be really helpful to patients, and it's definitely worth studying further.
Finally, the most important finding, in my opinion, from this week is about hornets and alcohol. Tell us about that.
This new study showed that the Oriental hornet, which is a type of wasp that's about an inch long, can drink 80% alcohol and show no ill health effects or behavioral changes. This is a level of alcohol tolerance that's not known in any other animal. And wow. Although the study sounds kind of silly, it's actually quite important from a biological standpoint. Hornets and a lot of other animals eat ripe fruits, which can naturally ferment and produce ethanol. And ethanol has a calorie density that's almost double that of sugar. So it can be a great nutrient source as long as you can handle the unintended side effects of it.
So if you are celebrating anything this weekend with a hornet, please do so responsibly. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you.
Jason Dinn is climate editor at Atmos in Washington, D.C. After the break, the science behind a sensitive political issue this election season, third trimester abortions. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. The November election is a little over a week away, and in many states, early voting is already happening. As we continue our coverage of how science is showing up on the ballot, we'll focus on one of the top issues among voters. Since the overturn of Roe v. Wade, many states have curtailed access to abortion. In total, 13 states have laws that have banned abortion. In particular, there's been a focus on abortions in the third trimester of pregnancy. Some of the rhetoric is inflammatory and false, but even among some pro-choice politicians, there's a tendency to deflect attention away from these procedures later in pregnancy. Though third trimester abortions are rare, they make up only about 1% of abortions in the United States, they are often the most stigmatized. They are only legal in a small number of states, and only a fraction of providers perform them. So, what's the real science behind this issue? Joining me now to help us better understand third trimester abortions are my guests, Dr. Katrina Kimport, professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco, and Dr. Kara Huser, a maternal and fetal medicine physician who specializes in high-risk pregnancy and complex abortion care, based in Salt Lake City, Utah. Both of you, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Huser, I want to start with some basic terminology here. When we talk about third trimester abortions, or as some people call them, late-term abortions, what does that actually mean?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because late-term is not a medical term that we use for any type of abortion care. Pregnancy has been conventionally divided into three trimesters somewhat arbitrarily. Sometimes people also divide it into before 20 weeks or after 20 weeks. And people tend to think of abortions that happen either in the second or third trimester or after 20 weeks in a different way than we think of abortions that happen earlier in pregnancy. People have more feelings about that. They're often more stigmatized. And so this is generally what is under the umbrella of quote unquote late term, although I do want to emphasize that that is not like an accurate medical terminology. And we would say abortion after 20 weeks or abortion at X gestational age or abortion in the third trimester.
Dr. Kimport, in your research, you've interviewed many people who've had third trimester abortions. Can you outline the reasons that people seek abortions in the third trimester?
I've talked to dozens of people who've had abortions after the 24th week of pregnancy, as well as people who've had abortions at all different gestations in pregnancy. And the pattern that I found is that people need an abortion later in pregnancy because of sort of two main pathways. In the first pathway, they've received new information that wasn't available earlier that made this pregnancy no longer one they wanted to continue. So that might include new information about the health of the fetus. It might include new information about their own health. It might include that they are pregnant. Some people don't recognize their pregnancy until later in gestation. The other pathway that I found for why people need an abortion later in pregnancy is that they wanted an abortion earlier in pregnancy, but they faced so many barriers to being able to get to abortion care that it wasn't until after, say, the 24th week of pregnancy that they were actually able to present for care. And these barriers could include things like policy-related barriers. Something like an abortion ban is certainly a barrier to getting an abortion. It could also include things like stigmatization of abortion, and sometimes things that aren't related to policy at all, such as somebody who prevented them from traveling. So these are the sort of two main pathways that I found for why somebody might need an abortion later in pregnancy. To be clear, these are not that hard to imagine once you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who might be having this experience.
And Dr. Huser, your specialty is working with patients who have really complex and challenging decisions to make about their pregnancies. For example, if a patient finds out about a life-threatening fetal abnormality during the third trimester, can you walk me through the options you present to your patients in this situation?
Before I walk through that, I do want to say that while most of my patients are coming to me for abortion care because of an unexpected fetal finding, the reasons that Katrina laid out earlier for people seeking abortion care in the third trimester are all valid. People who need care regardless of the reason. However, in my clinic, because I do high-risk pregnancy care, much of the time we're finding out about a severe fetal finding that wasn't apparent earlier in pregnancy. When we find out about these devastating diagnoses, you know, as you can imagine, this is life-changing for a family. And so, first of all, I encourage everyone to A, take some time before they make any decisions, and B, I always offer everyone a second opinion. So once we identify a fetal diagnosis that is life-limiting or unlikely to be compatible with extrauterine survival, we offer our patients one of two options, really. The first one is to continue to carry to term, which is 37 to 42 weeks, have labor, have the baby. Sometimes a cesarean is necessary, especially in particular findings where a vaginal delivery is not possible. And I want to emphasize that we really support people who want to choose that path. And that is a very meaningful path that a lot of families choose and find to be very comforting and something that is very meaningful to them. The other path that we offer patients is to end the pregnancy early. This is another way of saying having an abortion or early delivery. In those situations, there are many patients who do not feel that it is in their own best interest or the best interest of the pregnancy to continue to carry to term. And those patients may elect to end the pregnancy early. There's a number of ways of doing that, and I walk them through those options, which I'm happy to talk about as well.
Yes. Could you walk us through the different options for procedures in that situation?
The first way that is always an option is an induction of labor. This is very similar to induction of labor at term. Sometimes we use slightly different medications, but the process itself is very similar. You come into labor and delivery, you get some medications to begin contractions, they experience labor over a number of hours, they have a vaginal delivery, and then usually in these situations, not universally, but often, the family wishes to spend time with that baby. And it's actually a really profound experience. And their family members, there's pictures, it can help the healing process for these families. With this choice of induction of labor, there's also the option of having an injection to stop the fetal heart prior to labor. Some families choose for that because they really are worried about any suffering that might occur, or they are simply, for whatever reason, would prefer that there not be a chance that the baby emerges with a heartbeat. The other way to end a pregnancy is a uterine evacuation. So from the patient's standpoint, they have some type of sedation or even general anesthesia. It's very similar to like a dilation and curettage that you might have heard about in other settings. And it's more of a procedure where we use instruments to empty the uterus. In those cases, with the uterine evacuations, especially later in pregnancy, those are accompanied by a fetal injection that will stop the fetal heart prior to removing the pregnancy from the uterus.
And my next question is for Dr. Kimport. Abortion in general is stigmatized, but abortion later in pregnancy is even more so. Why do you think that is?
When we're talking about abortions later in pregnancy, a lot of these discussions are taking place without people actually knowing anybody who's had this experience. So even while we're hearing a lot of discussion, maybe in political discourse, maybe around the kitchen table, it's not been informed by people who've actually had this experience. And so to fill in for those spaces, there are a lot of unknowns. People have filled in a lot of myths. And I think that particularly when we're talking about abortion later in pregnancy, the fact that most of our conversation about abortion as a culture and for the last 50 years, maybe even longer, has really been focused on thinking about the fetus and hasn't had a way of talking about the person who's pregnant. And so when we are thinking really in centering the idea of the fetus, as the fetus has more developmental markers, it can become, especially for somebody who has no familiarity with abortion later in pregnancy, really hard to imagine what somebody who's pregnant must be thinking, how their decision-making could be working, and why possibly third trimester abortion could be the right choice for somebody. So a real response to that is to instead think about that person who's pregnant and recognize that we can trust them to make the best decision for them and their families.
Dr. Huser, does the stage of fetal development impact how you understand the abortion care you're providing?
There is something that often feels different to us about abortion later in pregnancy. I think that it's human nature to think of a pregnancy at 32 weeks in a different way than we might think of a pregnancy at 8 weeks. So I don't want to ignore that or minimize it. But when I come down to bedrock principles of, as Katrina said, who makes these decisions? As we've discussed, almost by definition, someone seeking abortion care in the third trimester finds themselves in a situation where something has gone quite wrong. In almost no case is that situation improved by the interference of the carceral state. When I think about who needs to do that moral calculus, and who needs to make the decision. And I think about the different stakeholders or the different players, and I think, should it be the government? Certainly not. Should it be the physician? Probably not that either, honestly. Should it be the person who's most impacted by the decision to have or not have a child, to bring another life into this world, and who knows their own life and circumstances best? Yeah. Like, that is the person best positioned to add the moral weight onto each side and decide what is the best decision for them. And it is my role as their physician to honor their choices and their independent ability to make those moral calculations and to trust them when they say that having a third trimester abortion is what they need to minimize suffering and is the right decision for them.
And have your views on this changed over time?
Honestly, yes. And this is something that I struggle a little bit to talk about because I don't want to send the message that there is something shameful or wrong about having a third trimester abortion. But I admit that in the past, I have felt discomfort with it, especially when I am the one actually providing the service. And so I've really had to sit with this and really kind of come back to my first principles and my core bedrock values. And as I've done that and thought about it, and as I've interacted more and more with patients seeking this care and sat with them and heard their stories, and when there is a person across from me asking me to help them, it feels impossible not to. It feels like an abdication of my ethical responsibility as a physician not to help them.
Well, Dr. Kimport, you've devoted a lot of time and energy as well to speaking with people who have had third trimester abortions. Why do you think it's so important to focus on these lived experiences?
So when we look at political conversations about abortion, sometimes there's this idea that there's some sort of common ground between people who are supportive of abortion, abortion rights, abortion access, and people who are opposed to it. And that somehow in our idea of finding common ground, that's been translated into this idea that we could have some fixed point in pregnancy, some gestational point after which would be not okay, before which would be okay. I think once I started talking to people who'd had abortions later in pregnancy, I understood how nonsensical the idea that there's a line in pregnancy after which abortion shouldn't be available, how nonsensical that is to their lives. People who are pregnant don't experience pregnancy by these specific cut points. So there was a person I talked to who received information that there was probably or potentially a fetal health issue. She was about 22 weeks gestation. She was told, we think there's a 70% chance that your baby is going to be fine, but we can offer you an abortion right now because you are under the state's gestational limit. And she said, you've got to be crazy to think that that's what I would want to do. I've got a 70% chance that my baby's going to be healthy and this baby is very wanted. As the pregnancy progressed and they were able to do additional testing and scans, they discovered that, in fact, not only was her fetus in that 30% that was probably going to be unhealthy, her fetus had one of the most severe cases of the observed fetal health issue. At that point, her calculus changed. This wasn't a pregnancy she wanted to continue. But at that point, the state had said, nope, sorry, you are beyond the limit that was our common sense agreement. As she said to me, who thought this was the right outcome of this policy? And when we think about the fact that the people who are beyond these gestational cutoffs are often people who, as Cara pointed out so eloquently, are experiencing some of the most complicated, sometimes heart-wrenching, sometimes harrowing circumstances that have led them to this point. And those are the people that we in a political consensus world have said, sorry, you don't get help. I think when we start from them, it shifts the way that we think about and talk about what it means to have a consensus, what it means to have a line, and what the impacts are for people who are among the most vulnerable in our society.
That's about all the time we have. Thank you, Dr. Huser and Dr. Kimport. Thank you both so much for taking time to be on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sophie, thank you so much for having us and being willing to talk about this important topic.
Dr. Katrina Kimport is a professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. And Dr. Cara Huser is a maternal and fetal medicine physician who specializes in high-risk pregnancy and complex abortion care based in Salt Lake City, Utah. We have to take a break. And when we come back, why butterflies are thriving after a devastating California wildfire.
The land all around was charred, but here, native milkweed plants had sprouted back up just weeks after the fire.
This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KQED Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. California's Park Fire scorched 430,000 acres of land this summer. It was the fourth largest fire in the state's history. But there's been an unexpected success story that has sprouted from the ashes of this charred landscape, a boon for monarch butterflies. Joining me to talk about this story is my guest, Danielle Venton, science reporter for KQED Public Radio in Sonoma County, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You went out with some experts to check out the post-fire landscape. What did you find?
I found the remains of a fire that had burned very intensively over an enormous area. I'm really interested in how prescribed fire can be used to make landscapes more healthy and protect against the worst, most destructive fires. So I visited areas that had been prepared for fire with prescribed burns, and I saw lots of places where these burns had helped slow and calm the fire, saving houses, saving the older, bigger trees, and a few places where the fire burned hot and out of control anyway. But in looking at these different examples, I came across something I had never seen before, something almost no one alive today has. I was checking out the Big Chico Creek Ecological Reserve. I was with Don Hankins. He's a professor at Chico State. He teaches classes in geography with a focus on fire. He's also a native person. He's a California Plains Miwok traditional cultural practitioner. And he showed me a bright yellow-green patch in a meadow. The land all around was charred, but here, native milkweed plants had sprouted back up just weeks after the fire.
Their flowering period is in this location is usually the later part of spring, early part of summer. So they would have already set seed at the time the fire had come through. And this year we're getting another round of flowers. And maybe we'll get another set of seeds. And I'm thinking the timing of when they flower will probably coincide about the time that monarchs are making their migration back south.
And this is something they're not known to do, flower and set seed more than once a year.
And what's the relationship between this milkweed and monarch butterflies?
For monarchs, milkweed is breeding habitat. The adults use the flower for nectar, and the leaves are the only thing their larvae, the caterpillars, will eat. And the milkweed provides protection to the caterpillar. Milkweed holds toxins called cardenolites. Monarchs are fine with these, but most other animals aren't. It'll make them vomit. The caterpillars store this poison in their body, and it gives them their bright coloring, white, yellow, black stripes as larvae, and the black and orange that's so striking as adult butterflies. This coloring is a warning to birds. Don't eat me. I taste bad, and I'll make you sick.
And in your reporting, you learned that what's happening this year with milkweed ties in with some indigenous knowledge from the past. What did you learn about that?
Native tribes of Central California tended milkweed with fire and used the plant's fibers for garments known as feather belts, weaving fibers together with feathers from important bird species into these velvet-like textiles decorated with geometric patterns. While milkweed and such birds were once abundant, today they're comparatively rare. And Hankins believes by seeing this, we're coming back into some indigenous knowledge that hasn't been practiced in a long time.
And monarch butterflies are near the brink of extinction. Could this knowledge help us bring their population back?
It could be helpful. It's going to take more than this, of course. The loss of milkweed habitat due to pesticides has been a major driver in the decline of monarch populations. For the western population, those west of the Rockies, they've also been hit by the loss of overwintering habitat. So there's lots of work to do. But I checked with Don Hankins to see if monarchs had been seen on this new crop of milkweed plants. And he said that better than that, larvae had been spotted on them. So that's really neat. I also want to mention all of us with gardens can help monarchs. One way is by planting native milkweed. But when doing this, watch out. A lot of people have planted tropical milkweed plants, They're brightly colored, they bloom longer, but they're not as helpful for butterflies. It messes with the signals of when it's time to migrate and increases the spread of parasitic diseases. If you do have tropical milkweed, you can try cutting it back in the fall so that it more closely mimics native species blooming patterns, and plant native varieties when you can.
That's all the time we have for now. I'd like to thank my guests, Danielle Venton, science reporter for KQED Public Radio in Sonoma County, California. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
To close out the hour, it's officially Halloween weekend. I'll be celebrating with a spooky movie. And I noticed we have quite a few new vampire offerings coming out. There's the new adaptation of Stephen King's Salem's Lot, the Nosferatu movie coming out in December, and my personal favorite, the final season of What We Do in the Shadows. And just as vampires suck the blood of the young to live forever, some researchers have found that certain elements in a young person's blood can actually improve the health of the old. This is possible through a spooky procedure called parabiosis, where the circulatory systems of two animals are joined, letting the blood from one flow into the other. That procedure has found its way into movies and TV as well, like in this clip from HBO's Silicon Valley.
Is Bryce your assistant?
No, of course not. He's my transfusion associate.
Which is?
Are you really not familiar with parabiosis?
Can't say that I am.
Well, the science is actually pretty fascinating.
Emma Gomez, SciFry's digital producer of engagement, who writes our Science Goes to the Movies newsletter, sat down with a neurologist who's used this technique to research aging and the brain.
Here to tell us more is Dr. Tony Weiss-Carre, a professor of neurology at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
So you've said that talking about parabiosis is a bit creepy before, and it reminds some people of vampires. Why is that?
That's right. Well, you know, just the idea that two animals would be sutured together at their flank sounds a bit spooky. And even though it's 100 years old, you know, I think it's still something that not everybody would feel comfortable about.
And could you just tell us, what is parabiosis and who came up with it?
Yeah, so this is a technique that was invented over 100 years ago by Paul Bert in France. And the initial idea was to test whether animals could share their tissues. And the model has really had a big impact in transplantation of tissues that we now take for granted. It also led to the discovery of sex hormone or an obesity hormone. And more recently, it has been used to study aging.
And so why is there a need to use this procedure in research at all? Like, what health conditions does this benefit?
So it's not directly a health benefit, but researchers have wondered whether something in the blood might be associated with age. So in other words, is the blood from a young animal, for example, or a young person different from that of an old one? And indeed, we see that the composition at a molecular level is very different between young and old people, between young and old mice. And so people then in the aging field wondered, what if we would expose an old organism, specifically old stem cells, to a young circulation, to factors from the young blood? The way I got into it is really from my interest in understanding Alzheimer's disease. And one of the key drivers of this disease is age. And we noticed that the composition of the blood changes dramatically with age. And so when my colleague, Tom Randall, made these discoveries that blood from young animals is beneficial for muscle regeneration, we wondered, of course, could the same be true for the brain? And he had indeed some hints that this might work. So that's really how we got into it and then wanted to understand better what are the factors and is old blood detrimental for young ones and so forth.
So you mentioned these factors in young blood, like elements in the blood of young people. Can you explain what they are and how they affect our health as we age?
Yeah, so we haven't really discovered enough about what exactly these factors are. My lab and others have focused on proteins specifically, and we see many proteins change in concentration from young to old. And some of them seem to have beneficial effects on the body. They maintain tissues, they maintain stem cells. And then we also find accumulation of factors that seem to be detrimental that accumulate with age, some of them involved in inflammation.
Right. So just so I'm understanding this, like you find this out by circulating the blood of a young animal into an old animal, and then you can see how that affects the older animal?
That's correct. So technically, you actually only suture the animals together at their flank, at their skin, and then blood vessels grow into this wound. And so you have a connection between the two circulatory systems. It's a very slow exchange. But we showed later on, actually, that you can simply collect the blood of a young animal and then infuse it into the old one and reproduce some of the same effects.
So you specifically study how these circulating factors can affect our brains and our cognitive functioning. So what are you researching right now related to that?
So we're really interested in how the brain ages. And working together with Tom Rando, we asked whether these effects that he saw on the muscle would also apply to the brain. We identified some factors that are detrimental that accumulate with aging, and we can block them. And at least in mice, show that this benefits the old mouse. And we also, as I mentioned earlier, we can transfer young blood into old mice, and the mice show improvements at molecular levels, at the cellular level, and then most importantly, their memory function becomes better and more like a young animal.
Oh, okay. Can you tell me a little more specifically what you mean by improvements? Like what about it changes?
Yeah, so as people get older, and especially if they get cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease, one of the characteristics is that they lose spatial orientation. So they may get lost in their neighborhood taking a walk. And interestingly, we see the same in mice. So you can imagine a mouse must be able to find, you know, where its nest is or where, you know, it was hiding some food or things like that. And as the mice get older, they have similar deficits, and we can actually quantify them. We can measure them. There's a number of different memory tests that have been developed for mice. And as they get older, they get impaired in these tests. And what we've shown is that if you give an old mouse infusions of young blood, then they do better again in these tests and show improvements in function.
Wow, that does kind of remind me of a vampire, I gotta say. So does this go the other way? Does circulating old blood from older mice into young mice do anything? When you create parabiosis, does the blood flow both ways or does it only go from one to the other?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So indeed, what we see is that the old blood is actually detrimental for a young organism. And it induces impairments and mimics aging to some extent. So we have now tools that allow us to measure molecular changes that are associated with aging. And we can show that old blood can accelerate these aging changes at a molecular level and also at a functional level. It can cause inflammation. And then, as I said earlier, the young blood can reverse some of these effects in old animals. So it really goes both ways.
So parabiosis is done mainly on mice, like you said, but how close are we to using the results of this research to develop treatments for humans? And what would that even look like?
So one approach would be to try and use blood donations from young individuals and give them to people with Alzheimer's disease, for example. And indeed, that's what we did in studies together with industry could show that at least in early stage trials that this is well tolerated and might be beneficial. This is something, as you know, in the hospital, you know, blood donations are used all the time, whether it's for if you lose blood in surgeries, but sometimes also exchanging blood if people have autoimmune diseases. And then people who are immunodeficient, they get parts of fractions that are isolated from blood donations. So it's something that is very frequently used already in the clinic, and it's possible that this could be adapted. The other direction is, of course, to try to find what are the individual components, what are the individual factors, and then produce them synthetically as we do for other drugs and apply them for the treatment of age-related diseases.
Wow. Parabiosis and research on young blood has popped up a lot in the media, like the Silicon Valley clip we played earlier, or even among some enthusiastic biohackers who get blood transfusions from the young. Does this actually work for humans?
We don't know yet. There are studies underway. There's a study in Norway that is testing this, and we did studies earlier in just small numbers of individuals to test whether young blood, blood from young people, could be beneficial for patients with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. But the results are still out, so we really need large clinical trials that are controlled with placebo so that we can figure out, does this really work?
So it's a don't try it at home situation right now, right?
Exactly. Don't do it in your kitchen.
Okay. And where do you see this field going in the future?
I think one of the key directions has to be to figure out what are the components. We know now it's not going to be one factor that can do it all. We know from studies, very broad studies, where we interrogate every cell in the body of a mouse and see how does it respond to old or young blood, that different cells respond in different ways to factors, suggesting that you would probably need more than one factor if you want to have very broad benefits, almost like a cocktail. The alternative is to find factors that are beneficial for one tissue. So if we could find a factor that is particularly beneficial for the brain, that might still lead to the development of a drug based on these discoveries.
You know, this has been a really enlightening conversation, but I definitely do think it's still a bit spooky. Do you have a favorite vampire movie or anything? Are you a spooky guy?
I don't know what that means. I don't have a favorite vampire movie, but it certainly fits the season.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for your time. This was a lot of fun.
That's great. Thank you.
Dr. Weiss-Carey, professor of neurology at Stanford University. If you'd like to read more about parabiosis and check out how it connects to a vampire movie that just came out, you can go to sciencefriday.com/vampire. I'm Emma Gomez.
Thanks, Emma. And that's all the time we have for this hour. Lots of folks helped make the show happen this week, including
Jordan Smudgick,
Rasha Aridi,
Charles Bergquist,
Shoshana Buxbaum.
Thanks, everyone. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick, senior news editor at New Scientist. I'm filling in for Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, sewer systems are crumbling across the country. We'll look at what's needed to fix them and how insects changed the human world from food to fashion. But first, this week, representatives of nearly 200 countries are gathered in Cali, Colombia for COP16, the UN's Conference on Biodiversity and Protecting Nature. In 2022, nearly every country in the world agreed on an ambitious deal to halt biodiversity loss by 2030. So, how's our progress, and what will this year's conference focus on? Joining me today to help break it down for us is my guest, Benji Jones, environmental correspondent at Vox, based in New York. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hey, good to be with you.
So get us up to speed. Tell us about COP16.
Yeah, so COP16 is, I would argue, the most important conference for nature in the world. And it happens about every 2 years. This year is happening in Colombia. And what's so important about these events is that it brings together all the environmental leaders from around the world, essentially, which includes environmental ministers, some heads of state even, as well as NGO leaders, scientists. So they're really trying to figure out a way to put an end to just this rampant loss that we're seeing in our forests and with wildlife as well. So this meeting, COP16, is under a global treaty called the Convention on Biological Diversity. And it's essentially an agreement among almost every country in the world to conserve nature and to share the benefits of nature. So things like cosmetics or medicines that are derived from plants and animals. That treaty was crafted in the 90s, and ever since then, we've had these conferences of all the governments that were part of that treaty that come together, and those conferences are known as COPs, and this COP 16 is the 16th one of those conferences.
But the U.S. is not really part of this, right?
Yes, that's right. So when I said nearly every country is a part of this agreement, the U.S. is the one exception in addition to the Vatican State, but that's very, very tiny. The U.S. is, of course, a powerhouse financially, economically, and it is not part of this agreement, and that's because the U.S. Senate has not ratified the treaty. So we've signed the agreement, but we haven't actually joined it formally through the ratification process.
Why not?
Yeah, so the U.S. tends to not like treaties in general because some lawmakers worry that by signing up to some global agreement, we're going to have to change the way we do things. It's going to infringe on our economics, our businesses, and so forth.
And I mentioned earlier that at the last conference, there was this big deal made to stop biodiversity loss by 2030. So how is that going?
I guess the short of it is not super great. So by most measures, we're still seeing pretty horrific rates of biodiversity loss. There was a recent report that showed that the average size of animal populations has declined by over 70% in the last 50 years. We've seen millions of hectares of forests cut down in the last year alone. 3 billion birds have disappeared from North America. Like, so there are a lot of negative signs for biodiversity, and it doesn't seem like we have made much progress in reversing those trends. There's been some positive movement, so we've done a good job at restoring some forests. But since 2022, when these countries agreed on this landmark deal, as you mentioned, which really, really was a huge moment, it includes all these different targets for conserving nature, including conserving 30% of all land and oceans by 2030, we still have a very long way to go. So if you look at that target of conserving 30% of all land, for example, I believe the number globally right now is 17%. And if you look at the oceans, we've only conserved about 8%. And again, we're trying to get to 30% by 2030. So we're still a long ways off, and that is pretty concerning.
Let's talk about one of the big topic areas of this year's conference, the idea of who gets to profit from the DNA of wild organisms. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is one of the thorniest topics that will come up at COP16. Lots of medicines and cosmetics and other products that we use, that companies sell, are derived from nature. So you can think of things like aspirin derived from some kind of bark, or penicillin from mold, even Botox comes from a microbe. And companies make a lot of money from these products, even though they are derived from nature. There's been a history of companies in wealthier countries taking natural products, so taking microbes, animals, and plants, using them to create products, again, like medicines or cosmetics, selling those products, making a bunch of money, and then not sharing the benefits from those products, whether it's money or even just access to medicines, with the countries which those animals or plants came from. So this is called biopiracy, basically like stealing one country's nature, commercializing it, and then not giving that country access to it. And there are a bunch of examples of this that have come up. So that's a problem. There is a sort of solution to this, which is that under that convention, under the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, countries are able to manage access to their resources. So if you're a scientist working for a company that is making cosmetics, you may need to sign some sort of benefit sharing agreement to extract resources from that country. So if you want to go into the Amazon and take, I don't know, rare plants that create some sort of compound that's useful for a drug, you might need to agree that you will share the medicine back with the country. You might need to agree to give them other resources like access to labs so that they can do their own data analysis and make their own products or whatever it might be, or money as well. And so there is a way to manage access. But a big issue with this is that now a lot of the plants and animals and microbes that companies use to do research for their products are present in a digital form. So basically like the digital version of biodiversity. And by that, I mean all these different plants and animals that are used to create products, we sequence their DNA, their RNA, their proteins. That sequence information is uploaded to databases. Those databases are, for the most part, open access, free for anyone to use. And so now companies can use genetic data in a digital form to create things, products, cosmetics, etc., without actually having to go into a country and extract some kind of physical sample. So that means that companies that are using the genetics from wild animals from other countries don't necessarily need to share benefits from those products under any kind of official agreement. So it's a way to kind of skirt this convention and the rules that it has for sharing benefits from nature.
Well, I mean, do you think that they're going to come up with a sort of one-size-fits-all rule for what to do about that? Or is this going to be one of those things where it's a case-by-case basis?
Yeah. So if there is news that's going to come out of this conference, it will be related to an agreement about what to do with this digital genetic information and who should manage it and benefit from it. I would say it's sort of 50-50 right now whether countries are going to reach an agreement. You have a lot of the wealthier countries that don't want any sort of mandatory benefit sharing related to this digital sequence information or DSI. You have a lot of developing countries say, look, like companies in sectors that rely on the sequence information should be mandated to pay into some kind of fund that will then send money to developing countries or countries that have high biodiversity. But it's not clear just yet whether there's going to be an agreement on this. And it is going to be very, very contentious just because there's a big, kind of north-south divide between developed and developing countries around what to do here.
And what are the other big topic areas of this conference?
Yeah, so the other big one I would say is money. How to raise more money for biodiversity conservation. So about 2 years ago, a report came out that identified that there was a $700 billion gap yearly for funding conservation. So if we want to stop the decline of nature, protect biodiversity, we need to come up with another $700 billion a year. And so the big deal that countries struck in 2022, this landmark deal to conserve nature, mentions that there's the $700 billion gap. They mentioned some of the ways to find that money. So rich countries should be paying poor countries for conserving their biodiversity. We should see the private sector involved. We should also see subsidy reform. So basically, figuring out how to close the $700 billion gap in funding for nature is going to be another kind of really hotly debated topic at COP. And it's not totally clear that we'll see agreement on that either.
I mean, is there any way to combine those two? Like use some of the profits from organisms' DNA to fund conservation?
Sophie, that's a great question. And one of the ideas on the table is just that. So creating a fund that comes from payments from companies that rely on DSI, and that fund would raise money that would then go towards closing this funding gap. I think there's just a question of how much money that would actually create. Like, there are a lot of skeptics that, like, if you're actually trying to get companies to pay into a fund, like, they're not going to actually pay that much money. So it's not going to make a ton of headway on closing this gap. But it's definitely an idea on the table and something that a lot of countries want to see.
And COP16 can produce these big global agreements. And we've seen this before with other global agreements, like the Paris Agreement on climate. But the question is, do they even work?
Oh, God. That is a very good question, because I often feel a little bit jaded when I go to these events and the level of ambition is super high. Everyone seems to agree on what needs to happen when you're in these spaces. And you see similar things at like New York Climate Week, for example, super high energy, a ton of excitement. But then when everybody returns back to their own countries and faces priorities that might be very different than what these environmental leaders are agreeing to, you tend to see a lessening of the ambition. So there was actually a set of sort of similar targets agreed to in 2010 called the Aichi targets. Those targets were supposed to be met by 2020, and not a single target was met. And so there has been this disconnect between ambition and reality. I think on the bright side, biodiversity is getting more attention than it ever has before. And by setting these ambitious targets, you at least raise the bar for what people think will happen. And it does, I think, move the needle at least a little bit. It kind of lights a fire under the private sector to do more around this stuff, governments feel more motivated to do conservation, and really just getting everyone in the room at the same time, like that alone is a pretty big deal. So I don't think that there's no purpose to these events. I think that the kind of pressure just needs to be applied constantly for anything to happen.
That's all the time we have for now. I'd like to thank my guest, Benji Jones, environmental correspondent at Vox, based in New York.
Thank you.
We have to take a break. And when we come back, a close look into how crumbling wastewater infrastructure threatens public health. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. As we head toward Election Day, we've been hearing about a lot of national issues, but wastewater has not been one of them, despite a sewage crisis in many American cities. Science Friday's John Dankosky is here with more. Hi, John.
Hey, Sophie. As I'm sure you know, in most U.S. cities, when you flush the toilet or wash your hands, that water and whatever else is in it, it flows through the pipes in your house down to public sewer lines. If you can believe it, there are more than 800,000 miles of these pipes crisscrossing the U.S., and these pipes, they're getting pretty old. A lot of these pipes and the systems that rely on them were installed decades or even more than a century ago. So these pipes are starting to crack. Others are getting blocked up with lots of gunk. In this kind of broken water infrastructure, it can create smelly, expensive problems, sometimes sending raw sewage into yards, streams, and even into people's homes. Here to talk with us about this is Shayla Farzon. She's a science journalist and editor with American Public Media. Shayla, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we've got sewage ending up where it shouldn't be. Take us to some places where this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, sewage backups are pretty common in the U.S., so they happen everywhere from, you know, Massachusetts to Iowa to South Dakota. But one place that's been really struggling with these backups for years is a small city in southern Illinois called Cahokia Heights, about a 10-minute drive from downtown St. Louis. And just for context, most of the residents there are Black, and about 40% live in poverty. And that's where I met Walter Bird. Walter's in his late 60s, and back in 1996, he built what he calls his dream house.
I liked the area because it was like a lot of wildlife around there, right? Rabbits, squirrels, everything was there. And it was wonderful. You might find some deer in the yard in the morning. They'd just be looking at you, you know. So, yeah, it was real nice. And then I had my garden and all this stuff. I had squash. I had corn. I had peppers. I had a nice, real nice garden.
So the house itself had 8 bedrooms, a master bath for him and his wife with a big whirlpool tub. It was basically everything Walter wanted. And then things kind of started falling apart.
Oh, boy. So what happened?
So along the road to Walter's house are these drainage ditches. I mean, they're essentially trenches. And he discovered that when it rained, these ditches would fill up with water and flood his yard. So he bought a pump to try to keep the flood water away from his house. But then water started showing up inside his house. And it wasn't flood water this time. It was sewer water. And it was coming up through the toilet. Here's Walter.
One of the bathrooms was full of waste, at least about 4 inches high in there. Toilet paper and waste backed up in there. And when I got the door open, the door seemed like the door swelled up a little bit. I tried everything, and you could still smell that smell in that house. Ooh.
He said it smelled like a hog pen. This happened again and again, and it wasn't just Walter's house. He figured out his neighbors also had sewage coming up into their homes, out of basement drains, you know, bubbling up out of toilets and bathtubs. And in some cases, when the water finally went down, you'd have inches of this thick, black, smelly sludge left behind.
It sounds terrible, but it also sounds like it's a pretty serious health problem.
Oh, definitely. I mean, raw sewage is full of all different kinds of things that can make us sick. Bacteria, viruses, parasites. Teresa Gildner is an assistant professor of biological anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. And her research team has found people in Cahokia Heights are infected with different parasites that spread through sewage, like tapeworms. Plus, up to 43% of residents they've tested have had this specific bacteria that infects the stomach lining. It's usually asymptomatic, but it can make people pretty sick. Here's Teresa.
So it can cause things like gastritis, that's kind of like inflammation in the gut that can be really painful. It might cause malnutrition, you know, if you're having a lot of pain, maybe you're not eating as much or the way you're digesting food is different. So that, and in kids, that could cause growth delays. So it can have these long-term consequences. It has been linked with things like stomach ulcers and even certain types of cancers in very rare but extreme cases.
And it's important to mention here that sewage isn't just backing up into people's homes, which would be bad enough. It's also flowing out into yards and parks and rivers, so it's contaminating the environment too.
Sheila, let's circle back to what's causing this issue. We've been talking about rainstorms and flooding, so I don't know, this has got to be connected to climate change, right?
Well, yes and no. So we know that storms are getting more frequent and more severe because of climate change. And Cahokia Heights is right at the base of these steep bluffs. When it rains, water flows down those bluffs and floods the city. So yes, big rain events really do matter here. But climate change is just one part of the story, because people are getting sewage in their homes even during relatively light to moderate rain events when the system should be able to handle it. And that's because the sewer and floodwater systems have been neglected here for decades.
What kind of neglect exactly?
Well, to understand what exactly is happening here, you have to know a little bit about how the system was supposed to work. So in this city, you have two separate systems. You've got your stormwater system that's supposed to take rainwater and then funnel it out of the city into waterways like the Mississippi. Then you've got your sewer system, which is a totally separate set of pipes that takes sewage and sends that out to a water treatment plant.
Yeah, and this makes sense, right? If you keep these systems separate, then when it rains a lot, that water goes back out into the river. The city then is just paying to treat the sewage, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly how the system's supposed to work. But the problem is, in this city, the stormwater and sewer systems are not separate anymore. And that's because the physical infrastructure, so the things like the pipes and the pumps, just haven't been maintained. So stormwater pipes are cracked or blocked up with sludge and tree roots. And then on top of that, some of the pumps that are supposed to be pumping floodwater out of the city are really old. Like, we're talking 60, 70 years old in some cases. So they don't work as well, or they don't work at all. And then the city floods. And we're not just talking about an inch or two of water here. Sometimes it can be waist deep in the streets. I mean, Walters had to get his boat out during some of the worst storms. I talked with Sean Sullivan about what exactly is causing this here. He's with the St. Louis District of the Army Corps of Engineers.
So storm sewers are undersized, unable to really accommodate the volume of inflow coming into them, whether they're either broken or whether they're blocked or whether the pipe diameters are just too small to handle some of the high intensity rain conditions that we're seeing. And therefore, that surcharged stormwater that now is ponding on the surface is also getting into the sanitary sewer network through manholes. And then it starts to, in essence, back upstream, we'll call it, back up through the pipe to the point where it has to overflow into places we don't want it.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand this. Because the stormwater drains and the pumps aren't working, then water starts to pool on the streets, which then, I guess, flows down the manholes, which are connected to this other system, the sewer system. And then that system gets overwhelmed, and it'll start to back sewage up into the homes.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Oh, so you mentioned that this is an issue that's happening in other cities. Are the reasons there similar?
That's a really good question. And to answer it, I want to bring in Becca Costello. She's a local government reporter at WVXU in Cincinnati. And she's also the co-host of a new podcast called Backed Up about the sewer issues there.
Hi, Becca. I love the name of the podcast, by the way. It sounds like Cincinnati might be dealing with some of its own sewage backups.
Yeah, John, that's exactly right. The symptoms here in Cincinnati are pretty much the same as what Shayla is describing in Illinois. And in Cincinnati, of course, we have that sewage and stormwater mixing together. But here, even though the symptom is the same, the cause isn't because of neglect. It's because the system was actually designed that way. And that's because Cincinnati has something called a combined sewer system. And that's where the wastewater and the stormwater all go through the same set of pipes to the treatment plant. But during heavy rain, it overwhelms that system. It backs up into homes. It backs up into creeks and rivers. But these systems are actually really common in lots of cities, especially older cities. According to the EPA, there's about 700 communities in the U.S. with these combined sewer systems. That includes cities like St. Louis, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. And it's really common in Europe, too. This, by the way, is why the Seine River in Paris got so much attention for water quality issues during the Summer Olympics just recently.
I remember that story, Becca. Yeah, we covered that. So how long ago did these cities put in these combined sewer systems? And I don't know, why did so many places build them like this?
So it's most common in cities established at least 150 years ago. They have these combined sewer systems because it's what made sense at the time. Now, we have to remember that these were replacing open sewers in ditches and cesspools, which were causing a lot of public health problems. They also smelled terrible, of course. It was way cheaper to build a system that took everything you needed to get away from the people, and do it at the same time. So this was the stormwater that was causing flooding and the sewage that was causing health concerns. Now, this was cutting-edge science at the time. It was a huge improvement over these cesspools, but obviously causing a lot of problems today.
Yeah, it seems like an improvement over cesspools, but still, for these combined systems, climate change, I assume, is more of an issue because there's just more water going into the system right now.
Absolutely. So with combined sewer systems, they really are directly tied to heavy rainstorms because it's just pouring down in a short period of time. And that is happening more often because a warmer climate means more moisture in the atmosphere. Now, it's important to remember this is not necessarily about the total amount of rain. You know, it could rain every day for a year and not necessarily overwhelm the sewer system. But in Cincinnati, for example, the average rainfall intensity has gone up by more than half an inch over the past 50 years, which half an inch doesn't sound like a whole lot, but this can absolutely overwhelm the system. And when that happens, the systems are designed to overflow into waterways, and this is a way to prevent it from backing up into streets and into homes. And when all this rain comes at once, the sewage can overflow and back up into basements. So you often see both of these problems happening together.
Right. And I mean, when we're talking about sewage going into waterways, like, we don't actually have great data on how much is flowing into rivers and streams from these combined sewers. But the most recent EPA estimate that we have was about 850 billion gallons per year. And John, that's enough sewage to fill 1.3 million Olympic-sized swimming pools every year going into rivers and streams. But, and this is a big but, that estimate is from 2004, so it's 20 years old. Lots of cities have cut down on sewage overflows since then. So the EPA says the total amount of sewage going into waterways could be half that amount. But again, we don't have updated data from them, so we don't know.
I can't believe we don't have more updated data, but let's get back to Cincinnati. So Becca, is the city trying to separate their sewer and stormwater systems now?
Well, some cities have gone that separation route. Minneapolis is the best example. They've actually almost completely separated their combined sewer system. But here in Cincinnati, it's too expensive and involved to actually separate the system because it means building a whole new set of pipes, which is a lot of money and a lot of construction. Instead, in Cincinnati, they're building mostly just bigger capacity, so bigger tanks, more storage, so that when all that rain comes, they can store it for a short period of time until the treatment plants are able to treat all of that sewage and stormwater. The city's also trying to reduce how much water gets into the system in the first place, and they're doing that with what's called green infrastructure projects, and the Lick Run Greenway is the best example. It's actually kind of been used as a national model. So the Lick Run was a stream that 100 years ago got put into a big underground pipe. And that neighborhood became one of the worst for sewer backups and combined sewer overflows. But what the city did is they returned that from a pipe back to an open stream now. And it can handle most of the stormwater from heavy rain, meaning the stormwater never has to mix with sewage. It can go straight to the Mill Creek, which ends up in the Ohio River. But it's important to say all of this is still extremely expensive. It's a multi-billion dollar effort over several decades. It's paid for by ratepayers. It's just not as expensive as it would have been to separate the systems.
How about in Cahokia Heights, Sheila? Are they trying to do something similar to fix the problem there?
In Cahokia Heights, what they're trying to do is basically repair and replace a lot of this broken infrastructure. You know, so like the broken pipes and pumps that I was talking about. And around $50 million in state and federal funding has been set aside to fix these issues. But, I mean, this is a big job. We're talking about 90 miles of sewers in just this one city. And on top of that, a lot of the system hasn't even been fully mapped yet. So this is just a huge undertaking.
I don't know. I'm no engineer, Shayla, but 90 miles of pipe and only $50 million to pay for it. I mean, I don't know. Is that really enough to fix this problem?
Yeah, it's a good question, John. And honestly, it's hard to know. I reached out to the mayor's office and the sewer department, but they didn't make anyone available for an interview. So as far as the total cost of how much it would take to completely fix this, that's kind of still a question mark. But what I can say is that they've started the work of repairing this system, which includes fixing pipes using this technique called cured-in-place pipelining. So basically, workers have these kind of long fabric-like tubes that look sort of like socks, and those tubes are soaked in resin. So the workers feed them into the broken pipes, inflate them, and then they blow really, really hot steam inside, which hardens the resin inside those fabric tubes. So that's why it's called pipelining, because it essentially creates a pipe inside of a pipe. The advantage with this technique is that it's a lot cheaper and faster than physically replacing the pipes, but it's just a temporary fix. And we should mention that the process of installing them has been linked to health problems for workers and residents elsewhere in the country.
So it sounds like this isn't a perfect solution, to say the least. So how are residents feeling about all this?
Not surprisingly, residents are just really tired of dealing with this. In some cases, they've had raw sewage coming up into their homes regularly for decades. And many of these people are elderly, and they're just worried that this isn't going to be fixed in their lifetimes.
Let's get back to Walter. He's the resident that you talked to in the beginning of our story. Is he still living in this dream home of his?
Well, Walter does still own that house that he built, but he doesn't live there anymore. He can't get rid of the sewage smell no matter what he does. And the house also has a mold problem at this point. He says he's hoping the city will just buy him out so he could afford to buy a different house and maybe have something to leave to his grandkids someday. I asked him where he'd want that new house to be.
I'm going to be like a bird. I'm going to go to the high spot. Y'all see me living on a mountain somewhere. I know. They said, why that house is on top of that hill right there? Because I'm going to be the only one way up. I said, I ain't going to have this problem no more.
Oh, my goodness. I hope he's able to find that higher ground that he's looking for. Shayla, thanks so much for bringing us the story. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Shayla Farzan is a reporter and editor with American Public Media. She was joined by Becca Costello, local government reporter at WVXU in Cincinnati. Becca is co-host of a new podcast called Backed Up. It's about the sewer issues in Cincinnati. And if you'd like to read more about the story and for a link to Becca's great podcast, you can go to sciencefriday.com/sewers. That's sciencefriday.com/sewers. I'm John Dankosky.
Thanks, John. After the break, an entomologist shares the story of how bugs changed the world.
This is Science Friday. I'm Sophie Bushwick. Did you know there are 10 quintillion individual insects on the planet? That is a 10 with 18 zeros after it, which means that for each and every one of you, dear listeners, there are 1.25 billion insects hopping, buzzing, and flying around. And this incredible menagerie of insects has fundamentally changed the world. Think honeybees, silk moths, fruit flies, and for better or worse, we can't forget critters like mosquitoes and fleas. The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture, is a new book that examines the many ways the insect world has changed our own, from fashion to food to engineering and beyond. Joining me is entomologist and author Dr. Barrett Klein. Welcome to Science Friday.
I am thrilled to be with you on Science Friday.
How far back in time does the relationship between humans and insects go? Do we know that?
Well, it most certainly precedes Homo sapiens. So when we hit the scene, insects were already on the scene for 400 plus million years. So being surrounded by insects, we had a source of sustenance, food. We heard the first musicians and were surrounded by insects that we could use in all manner of ways. So some of the hints of these connections came way later. So for example, you can look at The oldest depiction known of an insect by a human artist is the inscription of a cave cricket or a katydid on a sliver of bone found in the cave of Anlin in France. And then later, maybe 7,500 years ago, you can see the remnants of a painter's ochre pigment on a cave in eastern Spain depicting a robbery of a honeybee colony from a cliff face.
Wow.
Well, the very oldest, complete, and decipherable sentence ever found in an alphabetic script pertains to insects.
Okay, so what does it say? I have to know.
One of the archaeologists, Josef Garfinkel, helped to uncover this and translate it. You have 17 letters forming 7 words. And this transports us to the age of the Canaanites. And this is what the sentence said. May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard. Sure enough, those letters were just on a louse comb, a fine-toothed comb that tells us how ancient, deep, and conflicted our relationship with insects has been.
Oh my gosh. I mean, in reading your book, I'm seeing insects everywhere now. They're in food, they're in fashion, even in just the color red. Tell me about where that started.
Yes, indeed. In fact, some of your listeners may be imbibing a beverage, consuming a food, or caking on some cosmetics that feature the dried up, pulverized bodies of cochineal bugs. These are scale bugs that thousands of years ago were harvested, domesticated by Aztec and Maya people. Now, these scale insects don't look much like insects at all. Some consider them worms or berries or worm berries. Well, the conquistadors exported by the ton these scale bugs to the old world. Second only to exports of silver, this valuable resource changed the way we viewed, well, everything, color. So artists, textile manufacturers, and nobility took advantage of this, what Amy Butler Greenfield called the perfect red. So nobility, clergy, and others would take advantage of this source of red.
Wow. The perfect red. So there really are insects everywhere for those with the eyes to see.
That's right. So another scale insect, the lac insect, is harvested by millions of people in India and Thailand, and if processed properly, creates this coating. So imagine this. You've got a true bug that protects itself underneath this little armored excretion or secretion from her own body in order to safely feed on the plant's phloem or sugary solution. Well, an enterprising human comes along, finds this hard substance, liquefies it, processes it, and we can create our own protective layer over everything. So wood furniture, floors, plaster, electronics, cosmetics on your body, that shiny apple, that shiny piece of candy, that 78 RPM record may all be derived from the secretions of lac insects.
Wow. So if you had to pick just one, what singular insect do you think changed our world the most?
Yow! Well, I mean, we have over 180,000 known species of moths and butterflies, all of whom spin silk to form cocoons, for example, in which they can pupate. But one for 5,000 years has been domesticated to such an extent they no longer fly of their own volition. They utterly rely on humans, and that's Bombyx mori. That paved the path for the Silk Road. For hundreds of years, much of the world was connected for commerce, and that meant material goods being transported, but also language, ideas, religions, and disease, as well as genes. So the silkworm moth is probably one of the top contenders for most radically impacting human history.
One thing that you mention in the story of the silkworm insect is this story about a teacup. And I was wondering if you could tell it to us now.
Yes. So silk, thanks to Bombyx mori, they form cocoons as larvae within which they pupate. Well, picture one of these cocoons plummeting from a mulberry tree into a hot cup of tea. The tea belongs to an empress. And this is Leju. So we're talking 5,000 years ago. Legend has it, Leju witnessed this cocoon dropping in her steaming hot cup of tea. And the sericin, the adhesive that holds the fibers together, starts to melt. The lustrous fiber unravels, and Leju has a lady-in-waiting grab one end and walk and walk and walk, say a mile away in this single thread, exposes or reveals the potential that Leju, again, according to legend, conceives as being a new textile. And then imagining, as an entrepreneur, sericulture, the business of producing silk from the domesticated silkworm moth.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a bug that doesn't get the recognition it really deserves, the dung beetle. Can you tell us about the Australian Dung Beetle Project and what it taught us about the importance of these insects?
That's right. So if we look at the marsupials in Australia, they produce pretty dry, small excreta, dung. But when from England cattle were first brought to Australia, you had voluminous, moist, massive amounts of dung that the native dung beetles of Australia simply couldn't deal with. And dung beetles work on, as decomposers, dung in a lot of different ways. They'll roll balls away, most famously. Well, here, you didn't have the beetles who could cope with that dung. So this project, many years later, imported exotic dung beetles that were used to dealing with cattle by great number. And then gradually, the smelly fields of domesticated cattle and in the wilds started to clear up.
Wow. I also find biomimicry really fascinating, basically when we're looking towards nature to inspire design. And it seems like insects might be the most biomimicked group of critters out there, huh?
Absolutely. And I had a fun time looking deeply into story after story after story, whether it be biomedical research, architecture, art, robotics, to see how from head to tarsus, insects have solved engineering and other problems.
I really enjoyed the story about the CIA's insectothopter.
Ah, yes, that's a winner. So here you have the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency in the 1970s with their top secret operation to create a micro aerial robot that could service them for espionage. So how do you sneak up on two people in a secret conversation? Well, send in an insect. And originally they thought bumblebee, but bumblebees fly really erratically. And there was an amateur dragonfly aficionado on the team. He said, how about Anax junius, this large green darner dragonfly? So they built a robot that could fly thanks to a gas-operated motor in the thorax that would run through the body and glass beads for eyes that would be deformed given voices, and then lasers that would guide that dragonfly and bounce off those beaded glass eyes in order to recreate the conversation. Sadly, a slight crosswind threw the whole project off kilter.
Oh no!
But it did fly for 60 seconds and 200 meters.
All right, so not entirely a failure. But you also wrote about biomimicry in medicine, like with vaccines. So how do we look to insects to make better vaccines?
A lot of ways. So we can look to venom, surprisingly, to aid us biomedically. For example, bee venom therapy has been used for arthritis, arthralgia, Parkinson's, maybe ALS, multiple sclerosis, and other conditions. Poisonous proteins from caterpillars and cantharid beetles have anti-cancer properties. And even in the case of a vaccination for COVID-19, if you're allergic to one of the ingredients in the most popular vaccines, you could rely on Novavax, a vaccine that instead included an ingredient, proteins developed from a moth, armyworm caterpillar.
Your book also has this chapter called Act Like an Insect. So I want to know, what's one way that you are trying to behave more like an insect?
Well, when I lived in New York City, I did study mantis-style kung fu for a while. I was a winner. So picture Wang Lung long ago studying Shaolin kung fu and being defeated over and over and over again by his brother Feng, until studying on his own Confucian texts, heard a cicada nearby, grabbed by the speed and power of a mantis. This inspired him. So he took the mantis home, stuck a piece of straw right in the mantis's mug, and saw how the mantis would use raptorial forelegs to evasively maneuver or grab whatever object was presented to him. So learning the movements of the upper body of a mantis compelled Wang Lung to learn this art until he defeated his brother Monk Feng upon his return. So I've studied mantis-style kung fu, but I've been most impressed by dances, theater performances, fashion, and music that all incorporate insects in different ways. And as I traveled through the different stories, I found surprise after surprise after surprise.
As we've talked about, insects have fundamentally changed how we exist in the world. But at the same time, insect populations are crashing right now. How do we reckon with that?
That's right. All evidence suggests that anthropogenic change, human-induced catastrophes from global climate crisis, habitat destruction, pollution that can be light pollution, chemical pollution, invasive species spread, all of these factors and more exacerbated by humans have caused major declines in arthropods, those segmented, jointed-legged animals that are so diverse on the planet, and most of whom are insects. So with 1.1 million described species and so many more, maybe magnitudes more, undescribed species, we're experiencing losses like never before. We're in a major mass extinction of our own making, and we are experiencing some of the consequences of that. So not only do we experience ecosystem services faltering with insect declines, but we'll see all of the explicit as well as the hidden ways that insects affect our cultures start to dwindle, vanish, crumble, or change irreparably.
How is this relationship with insects going to be part of our collective legacy when humans are long gone?
We have a choice as to what legacy we can leave. We can leave a legacy of destruction, exacerbating diversity declines and the loss of not only insects, but all those organisms, including humans, who depend on insects. We can contribute to the loss of our cultural assets thanks to insects, or we can shift gears. For example, we've sent two physical objects that have escaped the heliosphere, the pull of the sun, two Voyager spacecraft, and we still have contact with one of them. And marvelously, one carries an image of an insect and a recording of a cricket. If those are ever intercepted, those cultural associations will come with them. We've sent out electromagnetic radiation that flies through interstellar space. If ever intercepted, you can hear Who's Wasp Man or all manner of insect music or reports about how insects have affected human culture.
Barrett, thank you so much for sharing this bug joy with us.
Wow, thank you so much for having me. The opportunity to think about how we as a collective can think more positively about our associations and celebrate the miniature marvels all around us. I just implore your listeners to take time to appreciate our biodiversity on the only living planet we know.
Dr. Barrett Klein is an entomologist and the author of The Insect Epiphany, based in La Crosse, Wisconsin. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. And you can join us throughout the week on social media or with our newsletters, sciencefriday.com/newsletters. Have a great weekend. I'm Sophie Bushwick.